Misquoted Bible Passages, Christian Hymnody, Confessional Lutheranism, Christianity and Culture. You can meet and hear Issues Etc. regular guests discussing these topics at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 13th and 14th in Collinsville, Illinois. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Registration is $100 per person. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 13th and 14th in Collinsville, Illinois. Issuesetc.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Everyone's concerned about it because it is everywhere. It used to be that media was confined to the front porch of your house when the newspaper landed there, or you'd walk inside, there would be the television and the radio. Of course, there are other forms of media more subtle than that, but when we talk about media, we usually talk about those various forms of communication, and sometimes it was rather crude, sometimes it was more sophisticated. Nowadays, it's not just sophistication, it's ubiquity. That means it's everywhere, and it's not everywhere because someone's putting it everywhere. We're carrying it with us, and the more we carry the various forms of media with us, a lot of people have noticed the more isolated we are. What effect does that have on the one place where isolation ought not to be tolerated? That is in the life of the family. We're going to talk about the effect of digital media on the family. Dr. T. David Gordon joins us. He's Associate Professor of Religion at Grove City College, author of the books Why Johnny Can't Preach and Why Johnny Can't Sing Hymns, and he's authored an article in the recent Modern Reformation magazine titled Media Ecology for the Family. Dr. Gordon, welcome back.
Thanks, Todd. Nice to be back.
We're going to use this term, media ecology. Can you give us a definition and how it bears upon the conversation we're going to have about the family?
Yeah, Neil Postman suggests that he got it himself from Marshall McLuhan that he had studied under in Toronto. And if we look at the second part of it, ecology, it's the study of the human environment. And so as we look at any environment, we're always asking the question, what life forms are we likely to find there? So, you know, the forest has different life forms than the ocean and so forth. And the desert has different life forms than the forest or the ocean. And so one aspect of the humane environment is, of course, the media that humans use to commune with one another, to communicate with one another, and to convey our understanding of reality. And so this particular discipline, media ecology, analyzes as best it can how, when you change the media that dominate a given culture, when you change those media, how does that change the environment, and therefore what kinds of human living does it discourage and what kinds of human living does it encourage?
Okay, so let's go back to the time, if we could, before the electronic media. That would be, if we could look at the media before radio and television.
Right. So if you go far enough back, 2000 BC, 1500 BC, Moses' generation, they were just developing writing. So those were all oral cultures to that point. And then they became manuscript cultures. And nothing really changed until the 15th century AD, so, you know, 3,000 years passed before the printing press. And then the printing press roughly had lapped the field for 450 years, that it had the place by itself, other than orality. And then at the turn of the 19th century to the 20th, the discoveries of both photography and the telegraph in the 1840s had now become culturally prevalent. So by the end of the 19th century, coming into the 20th, you have your image-dominant culture and electrical-dominated culture. And each of those is profoundly different than printing press culture.
So are the electronic media that we move within, we live, move, and have our being today, are, in your thinking, are they simply extensions of photograph and telegraph, or are they something else?
They are something else. Most media ecologists divide history into four or five eras: the oral era, the manuscript era, the printing press era, and then they have the electronic slash image era, because those two happened at the same time in the late 1840s. And then they add the digital era as a new one that began roughly at the turn of the millennium. And the difference is, even though our digital devices are also electronic, and even though they are also image-based, in that sense, like the electronic, they're so much smaller that they're far more portable. And so the television that I grew up with, it was, you know, stuck in our living room. It had three channels, and you could escape it very easily. In my pocket, you see, I could easily be carrying a smartphone that has Three Stooges cartoons and television programming on it. So the digital era, I think, is a different era than the photographic and electronic era simply by their ubiquity. It's so easy to travel with an iPad or a smartphone, so that, you know, probably 90% of the people on my college campus have a digital device with them at all times.
I was a very early lay user of the internet. This was, probably 1990. I remember sitting in my office in the basement of a parsonage I resided in and having I would call it now an instant message chat with a fellow pastor, because we'd figured out how to do this from computer to computer. We were both tickled by it, but we couldn't have that conversation outside our offices. Our computers were heavy.
Right. And yeah, those desktops were heavy. Those were heavy machines.
So, and we couldn't carry them with us. Now, what changed with regard to media ecology when that little textual conversation could take place? For instance, today I was having the tire on my car fixed at Walmart, and I was texting with about four different people. What changed between those two?
The two biggest changes, we can use D's for both of them, then we can remember them perhaps. The two biggest changes are distraction and disincarnation, if we can be permitted a theological neologism there. The two big things are distraction and disincarnation. Distraction because the digital devices are alarming. They're literally alarming. They alarm us. And their images distract us in a different way than, for instance, opening a page of Robert Frost's poetry would. His poetry is words that aren't moving. A moving image demands our attention in a way that a still image doesn't, because we're afraid we will, quote, miss something. So when you consider that they alarm us, they vibrate in our pocket, or they even make an auditory report or alarm of some sort, we are constantly distracted. And if the human neurology is as they say it is, constantly in flux, constantly changing, they call it neurogenesis. What's happening then is, every time I only focus for 3 minutes before being distracted, my neurology adjusts to that, and it becomes adept at 3 minute spurts of attention, but inept at lengthier concentration. And so, every time you and I are distracted through the day, it shapes us to either have a healthy executive attention span or a retarded executive attention span. So that's an enormous aspect of it. People are just distracted many more times daily than was ever the case in human history, because these devices go off. Some studies say that the average worker in the American corporate setting works on average in 3 minute bursts, that every 3 minutes is distracted by something else. And that's remarkable if that's the case, because the switch time between tasks means that the employers are getting very little work out of people.
Now, that's the work environment, alarming enough as it is, staying with the distraction element of this. What does that do to the family?
What it does to the family is it forces us to be literalists and effectively to shout at one another. You know, old married couples can sometimes look up at one another and sort of just alter their posture a little bit, and the other one knows that conveys disapproval or curiosity. Body language is an enormous, enormous aspect of rich human communication. Sometimes when someone asks us a question, it's important for us to give a nuanced answer. If I was dating my wife 30-some years ago and she said, "Would you like to see a certain movie Friday night?" I could say, "Well, And even before I went further, just by saying, well, with my voice rising like that, what that conveyed was a willingness to do so if she felt strongly about it. But on the other hand, obviously, something less than enthusiastic response. Nowadays, you're virtually required to shout yes or no, and certainly on digital devices you are. So what happens is people aren't noticing those subtle little meta-communications that we convey by body posture, by the tone of our voice, by whether we're speaking vigorously or silently. And as a Christian, I think that what's profoundly lost in this, therefore, is we are inattentive to people unless they virtually beg for our attention. And that is an enormous social loss.
I've thought about this and actually given a couple presentations on it. My aversion to the emoticon, you know what I'm talking
mm-hmm,
about.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed kind of trite and ridiculous and in and of itself distracting, but I came to realize why it exists. It exists because a kind of back to the distracted textual conversation that everyone seems to engage in at different levels all day long. You need that new language to say, hey, I'm not being serious, or hey, I'm saying this in a friendly way.
Correct.
And
correct.
Not in an angry way.
Correct. Because if you don't have those, if you say something you think is, let's say, just witty or playful, there's a fine line between whether it's playful witticism or sarcasm. And so you have to throw some literal sign in there to let people know what's going on. And the capacity to read people and to notice what's happening with them, I think, is an essential part of Christian love and Christian charity. If a person is grieving, they will probably, by body language of some sort, convey that they're anxious or grieving to us. But they won't necessarily shout rowdy at the top of their lungs, I'm grieving or anxious. We have to look at them and say, Todd, you okay today, buddy? You're looking a little distracted. And then the person might, you know, the lip might quiver a little bit and say, well, we just learned that mother has cancer and it looks like it's going to be very serious, right? Then the person opens up to you. If we don't even notice those kinds of changes in demeanor because we've got our head down into some digital device, and then when we look up, we just glance and notice the obvious, we're going to miss many, many opportunities for Christian encouragement and Christian counsel.
Dr. T. David Gordon is our guest. We'll be with him for another 15 minutes on the other side of the break, live this Monday, May the 5th. This is Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. If you got a question or comment, as we talk about the effect of digital media on the family, and we'll return to the subject of disincarnation after the break, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943.
You know you want to be there. A pile of pastors, a mountain of musicians, a boatload of laity, all passionate about worship, gathered together on the beautiful campus of Concordia University, Nebraska, this coming July, the 28th through the 31st. Comfort, comfort ye my people, preaching, praying, and singing the comfort of Christ to the troubled conscience and the broken heart. John Kleinick, Paul Solek, Betsy Werner, Brian Wolfmiller, Robin Lever, and the stash himself, President Matthew Harrison. Oh yeah, and two other guys named Wilkin and Whedon, along with a whole pile of your favorite Issues Etc. guests. Did I mention that the registration cost starts at just $175, or that full-time students, including seminarians and deaconess students, pay just $25 registration? Yeah, seriously. I told you, you want to be there. For more information, click the link, Comfort Comfort, on the Issues Etc. homepage, issuesetc.org.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Carpet, hardwood, tile, stone, laminate, you name it, they've got it at Vallo Floor Coverings in Edwardsville. Vallo's offers competitive pricing, a knowledgeable sales staff to help you with product selection, and name brands like Shaw, Congoleum, Mohawk, Florida Tile, and more. Vallo Floor Coverings, 1009 Plummer Drive in Edwardsville, 618-656-7788 or valofloor.com.
Do you wish your Lutheran school offered Latin, Greek, or logic? What about German or calculus? Right now, local Lutheran schools in two different states are utilizing Wittenberg Academy to expand their course offerings. Whether it's Latin for third graders or logic for seniors in high school, Wittenberg Academy can help. For your homeschooler or for your brick-and-mortar Lutheran school, we have solutions. To find out more, visit wittenbergacademy.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the effect of digital media on the family. Dr. T. David Gordon is our guest, Associate Professor of Religion at Grove City College and author of the books Why Johnny Can't Preach and Why Johnny Can't Sing. You'll find more about these books at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Dr. Gordon, you spoke before about distraction as part of the, you know, what happens when we are carrying this with us, holding this in our hands all the time, the digital media. How is disincarnation, the second of your D's there, how is it different from distraction?
First, let me give credit where it's due. I think I got this concern from Jacques Ellul and from Ken Myers with the Mars Hill Audio. I think those are the two authors who influenced me most on disincarnation. What the electronic technologies did, even before the digital, was they permitted people in New York to send a telegraph to someone in Texas. And so you could have, in some sense, live connection to someone who was materially many, many miles away. And the digital world has just increased this in spades. So what happens is it creates a kind of it changes the ratio of the distant to the proximate. We are facilitated in distant communion at the expense of proximate communion, we could put it that way. And what happens is, if we are not careful, we come to regard physical presence with contempt. We are in the presence of another human being, and instead of making eye contact with them, talking with them, we're reading a text from someone who's 1,000 miles away. Worse, we pick up the phone and talk with someone who's 1,000 miles away, even though a human, as the bearer of God's image, sits right there in our very presence. And so it cultivates a discourtesy for incarnate humanity that I think is problematic, because if I regard your incarnation with contempt, I cannot, in some sense, but regard Christ's incarnation with contempt. If the psalmist was right, that he was fearfully and wonderfully made, he was probably talking not just about himself, but all who bear God's image in a fallen world. And so we're constantly in the material presence of someone who is fearfully and wonderfully made, whose parents' happiest day of life might have been when this person was born, and yet we act as though they're not even there. My grandfather, all the way up into his late 80s and up until 90 before he died, even when he was frail and walked with a cane, if he was seated in a room and a woman entered the room, he leaned forward onto his cane and stood up. He didn't do it quickly by then. He was getting old and frail. But he always acknowledged the material and physical presence of a lady entering the room. And nowadays, people act as though the people in the room aren't even there. They're communicating with people who are absent.
Okay, explain that, and perhaps you don't have an answer. I don't know. Why is it that in that social dynamic where I'm holding my smartphone or my tablet or my laptops in front of me, and I'm in the same room with my wife and my kids, why does the device demand more attention of me? I'm just asking, kind of not for a moral answer, but just a mechanical answer, if you will. Why does that device or whoever's on the other end demand more attention from me than the people who are sitting in the room with me?
Well, yeah, I mean, the question could be just put rhetorically. Should it? Mine's always, I show my students that the my two favorite features on my smartphone are my Greek New Testament and the off button. And mine is always off, and not always with me. Sometimes I have a couple, two or three days a week where I leave it at home intentionally, so it's not even in my briefcase or anywhere near me. So it is true that we can turn them off, and it is true that we could choose to simply check them two or three times a day to see if they're important messages, but we don't. And as my friend Greg Reynolds has mentioned, Greg's an Orthodox Presbyterian minister in Manchester, New Hampshire. As Greg has reminded me, our English verb communication comes from the same Latin root as the word communion. And so the question is not one of the richest things in life, our communion with fellow humans? And what kind of communion are we having if three of us are materially in the same room, but none of us is really communicating with each other, but with people who are absent?
Another concern that you raise with respect to the family and digital media is what you call the adolescent ghetto. What do you mean by it?
Yeah, Mark Bauerlein down at Emory, you know, wrote the book The Dumbest Generation, how digital technology stupefies American youth. And he's concerned about that, as is Christian Smith at Notre Dame. The nature of being a young person is that we have a strong peer separation anxiety. We don't want to be left out when our peers are doing something. Now, when you and I were younger, that meant, for instance, if we were on the playground or on the bus going to or from school, we didn't want to be left out of anything that was going on, whether it was hijinks or a conversation or someone picking up a baseball game. In the digital world, however, that anxiety is there even when you're not materially in the presence of other young people, because young people are always wondering, well, are they texting each other, tweeting each other, writing on each other's Facebook walls, and am I being left out? And so an enormous amount of their free time is the maintenance of their own presence in the digital social network. They feel compelled to do that. A young person who doesn't upgrade their Facebook page, but let's say once or twice a month, is just not cool. You've got to be constantly adding something up there, photographs of you and others doing cool things, preferably some videos, something clever, a good quick riposte to what someone says when they write on your wall. It's almost a burden for them to do it, and in the process of devoting so much time to it, they almost never notice the adult world. When they're very young, they're potted up. They almost always have some kind of a music device. And even when they're with their parents in the car, for instance, they've got earbuds in their ears, and they're listening to music elsewhere. And so they really never overlook the adult world. They never oversee it. It's not really present to them. And this is why Christian Smith says they're so retarded in their adult development. They don't become adults until, on average, 28 years old now, instead of it used to be 22. And the reason is they never notice adults. They're constantly stuck in this adolescent ghetto, a digital world that connects them to other teenagers, but not to adults.
Is it possible, with only about 30 seconds here, that ghetto extends into past 27, into what should be adult years?
Yeah, I think so. I think there are individuals for whom it takes them right on up into their 30s. Some, you see, just appear never able to make adult commitments.
Dr. T. David Gordon is Associate Professor of Religion at Grove City College. He's author of the books Why Johnny Can't Preach and Why Johnny Can't Sing Hymns. He's author of an article in the recent Modern Reformation magazine titled Media Ecology for the Family. Dr. Gordon, thank you very much for being our guest.
Todd, it was great to be with you again.
Speaking of singing hymns, Pastor Will Wheaton, Director of Worship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, is going to be making a presentation at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference that's June the 13th and 14th right here in Collinsville, Illinois. Pastor Wheaton's going to be making the case for Christian hymns. Now, the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, again, June 13th and 14th in Collinsville, Illinois, that's less than a half hour's drive from St. Louis, so it's very easy to get to, very accessible, and registration is filling up. I think we're at 155 the last time I checked, and we still got plenty of room and plenty of time for you to register for the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. You can do so by going to our website, issuesetc.org. Look for the Making the Case logo. If you have any questions or you want to register the old-fashioned way, you can call Craig at 618-223-8385, 618-223-8385. Ask for Craig. When we come back, Hour 2 of Issues Etc., we'll spend with Tim Gagline talking about the importance of the natural family and teaching a Sunday school lesson with Pastor Tom Baker, John healing a lame man in Acts chapter 3. Stay tuned.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Have you wondered what classical Lutheran education is all about? Are you a Lutheran homeschooler, pastor, or teacher? Would you like to be equipped to teach more effectively? Join the Consortium for Classical and Lutheran Education, July 15th through the 17th at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. Find the conference schedule recently posted at ccle.org. Discover the education that is our Lutheran heritage, ccle.org.
When you need a friend, you have a friend in Jesus Christ, the Good Shepherd, and friends among His people at Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, Arnold, Missouri. At Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, we offer Christ-centered word and sacrament ministry, inspirational liturgical worship services, and faithful preaching and teaching. Sunday worship services are at 9 a.m. Sunday school and Bible class are at 10:30. We also have an excellent Christian preschool. We invite you to join us. Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, 2211 Tenbrook Road, Arnold, Missouri, 636-296-1292.